shares, the market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that doesn't believe in thoughtless siloed ideology. We'll get to why in a second. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me as always is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc. How are you?
G'day, Captain. I'm very good.
I'm pretty happy with today because we've got a special guest in the studio, but I won't reveal who just yet. Mate, we've had some great feedback on our recent podcast. You were off for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically because our new listeners didn't want to hear me just bang on for, you know, 45 minutes straight, we actually had a couple of guests. So if you haven't, listeners, if you haven't had a chance yet, go back and have a listen. We've had Warren Hogan, who is now UTS professor, and he was the former, or is the former, chief economist of ANZ. And before that, or after that, sorry, we had Eliza Owen from CoreLogic, their head of Australian research. So had some really good feedback on that. We thought we'd keep going, and we thought we'd have another expert in her particular field, a lady. There's a bit of a hint. Wonder who it might be. Now, our heritage, Doc, and our focus generally is shares. That's kind of our thing, right? But as our listeners know by now, we do have a broader interest in general personal finance. Our Money Hacks little mini podcast has been very successful and very popular. And I've got to say, I personally think that we kind of unnecessarily silo ourselves as investors sometimes. You know, there's the shares guys, there's the property guys, there's the foreign exchange guys, there's, God help them, the Bitcoin guys. I'm not exactly sure that's particularly helpful. A, because you might be missing opportunities, but B, because sometimes thinking about a different asset class can actually be really, really useful. So I'm pretty pleased. Well, we're not gonna do kind of the spruikers, we're not gonna do the usual kind of, you know, bias suspects. But in this case, we've got a fellow traveller, you know, a lady named Veronica Morgan. G'day, Veronica.
Well, hello.
How are you?
Great intro. Good.
Now, well, it is a good intro. I want to tell our listeners a little bit more about you before we get into asking you some questions. So you're a property buyer's agent. We'll ask a bit about that in a minute. You're a TV show host. You're a fellow podcaster. And as of this month, in fact, as of next week, a published author.
Ooh, yes.
Now, you and I crossed paths at Sky News.
All those
back in the day. Exactly.
Away you go.
And then I started listening to the podcast you do with Chris Bates called The Elephant in the Room. And for our listeners who are looking for another podcast, if you want to add some property to your shares, The Elephant in the Room is a very good podcast and well and truly worth your listen. I make it a regular weekly listen. Veronica and Chris were also kind enough to ask me to appear on that podcast. So this is something of a return favour. But more importantly, we wanted Veronica on because she has a lot of great things to say. So what struck me when we chatted, mate, was we had a very similar approach to investing in general, albeit that our asset focus is very, very different. You guys, the elephant in the room, the idea behind that, I'll let you talk a bit about it, but the idea of the kind of psychological biases that hold us back from success in investing, which is what we, well, frankly, bang on about relatively regularly, as listeners would know. So that's why I kind of wanted to have a chat, because there's a lot of kind of shared benefit and value. Also, frankly, you're going to have some new and different things to talk to us about, and we don't do property that often, so that's pretty useful. So that's why we've asked you to come along, but I'm going to have to get the big news out of the way because, frankly, that's what you want to talk about and what we want you to talk about is the brand new book. Now, we're a PG program. If you've got little kids listening, feel free to close their ears just for half a second. Nothing terrible. Your book is now going to be called Auction Ready. And the subtitle is How to Buy Property at Auction, Even Though You're Scared Shitless. Now, you bring out the hashtag, but we can't do hashtags on air, so we'll say the full word and ask for people's forgiveness. Now, you want people to buy the book. We won't ask you to give too much away, but just give us a bit of an outline of what the book is going to be like, what you've written about, and why you're hoping people might buy it.
I love auction. I'm just so interested in it, you know. I mean, I
find it... makes the block come alive.
Yeah, I find them fascinating. Mind you, probably that's my least favourite auctions to watch, just quietly. But I find the whole human drama behind auction just fascinating.
Okay.
And I guess because I understand what's going on, I get the language and I know what agents are trying to achieve and I know what they say and how much is BS versus how much is, you know.
What's the proportion just quickly between the BS and the real stuff?
Well, you know the real problem, they're not all the same. Some agents are really, really good at being very open and honest and transparent with you, and others are full of BS. So, you know, you've got the 100%ers versus to the maybe 5%ers.
Okay, right. So it's not even split. It's either one way or the other, right?
Well, there's a continuum.
Okay.
There's a definite continuum.
All right.
And that's sort of in the book as well, you know, talking about the different types of agents, you know, and how to interpret price guides. But so buyers often fear auction, and there are benefits to buyers at bidding at auction, and there's also benefits in not bidding at auction, in making offers private, understanding really what's going on so that you can make really clear decisions around that is really, really important if you want to succeed at this game.
Interesting. Let me ask you then, Are auctions better for buyers or for sellers?
Well, they can be both.
Okay.
Right. And it very much depends on conditions and what's been going on. So obviously in a seller's market, you know, every man, his dog wants to go to auction.
Of course you're going to auction.
But, you know, if the agent has overquoted the property, where sometimes they do, and we've got all these different archetypes of agents that we work with in our office, you know, and you have a defender, for instance, who might have quoted high to get the business, and they actually truly believe it.
Yeah.
And the vendor believes it too. And the pair of them are, you know, arm in arm, and they're all agreeing on what the price is at. And sometimes they overquote.
Yeah.
Not common because everyone's whinging about underquoting, but sometimes it happens. So therefore, in a situation like that, it's a good idea for a buyer to go to auction.
Okay,
because a lot of other buyers might have been scared off.
I like it. All right, mate. Well, let's before we keep going with that line of question, take me all the way back. Tell me the Veronica Morgan story. You're a property buyer's agent, so I want to know a bit about what that is.
Yeah.
For those who don't know. You're also now an author. You also in a past life were a real estate agent. So you've seen it from both sides of the coin. Tell us a little bit about your career thus far. Where have you been? Where are you now? Where are you going? What's the Veronica story?
So I've been in property now for 20 years, and I started in real estate selling, and I sold for 6 years, and I did very, very well at it.
Well done.
And, you know, to be quite frank, I got into it because I had a failed business and I needed to pay some debts.
Okay.
And I was always interested in property, but when I got into it, it was like, oh, I get this. I get what's going on. I get the human element. I get the property element, and I like it all. But after 6 years, I really was a bit bored. I mean, selling property for me was a bit like Groundhog Day.
Okay.
So every day I got up, right. I was like, oh, I'm going to do it again. And I'd lost my, really had lost my mojo. And it really coincided with when I had my daughter. So that was a bit lucky I took a year off.
Okay.
And I really did consider doing other things. But I really kept coming back to this idea of representing the buyer. Because I could see that it could be done better. And I could see that buyers are really underrepresented. It's an uneven playing field, let's face it.
Right, right.
And it doesn't matter how smart you are as a buyer, and I guess we get to the elephant in the room. I mean, you know, the subconscious mind and what, you know, our bias is and what drives us, they disadvantage us in many cases. And then you've got an uneven playing field in the sense that the agent actually holds much more information than the buyer does. So all that sort of led me to think, you know what, I've got great insights into this. I understand what's going on. Let's actually take it onto the other side, use my powers for good, not evil.
Or at least that's what you'd say. Would a real estate agent say the same thing about a buyer's agent, do you think?
Well, you know, and look, and I don't want to bag real estate agents I know I am a real estate agent. So, you know, for me to bag real estate agents would be pretty bloody stupid. But the thing is that a smart real estate agent gets that when they're dealing with a buyer's agent, a good buyer's agent, because we're not all good. I mean, unfortunately, in our business, we've got a very low barrier to entry, so that's another issue.
So not too dissimilar in financial services, just quietly.
Although you now have to have a degree.
Well, yes. If you're not already in the industry and you've been there for 40 years, you can get away with it.
Yeah, you're grandfathered a little bit the same with what's happening in property. But
funny that.
So yes, there's low barrier to entry, unfortunately. But when you're dealing with a really smart sales agent, not even a really smart one. I mean, just one that likes getting deals done.
Yeah, right.
You know, they'll look at us and think, okay, well, you've got a qualified buyer, your buyer's ready to buy, advising them, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Some of them sort of try to lean on us and they mistake what our role is. They think that we're just basically one of them and we're not. You know, our role is to help our clients buy without regrets.
So it's nudge, nudge, wink, wink, let's get a deal done here because you get some money, we get some money, everyone's happy.
And, you know, sometimes we use that if that's going to work for us, but they miss the point. But but the majority of agents do see buyer's agents as conduit to helping them.
The flip side is now in some degree of kind of recession or receding a little bit, the whole kind of agent-free, purple bricksy kind of approach where, hey, it's a reasonably easy market, you don't need a real estate agent, you don't need a buyer's agent, let's just do the deal, both save a bit of cash.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're going to tell me that that's not the best way to go about getting a deal done for either side. What's your thought, though, on that? I mean, at some point, you could argue a real estate agent and a buyer's agent cancel each other out because you're both getting paid fees and you're both trying to get the best. So if you're doing a great job, the agent's doing a great job, then you kind of get back to some sort of rational pricing. Is it not better just to go straight for the online purple bricks option and be done with it?
Well, if that's the only thing you're trying to achieve about price, yeah, sure. You know, if it's just purely transactional. But certainly in our business, what we want to uncover is actually what is the right property for you? Are you looking in the right area? Have you actually gone and got financed the right amount of money? You know, there's so much more involved. Are you looking into the future? Have you considered whether this asset is better than that asset? You know, as an owner-occupier, are you thinking like an investor? Because this is a massive, massive commitment. You know, you got all these eggs in this one basket. If you're an investor, you're thinking like an owner-occupier because at the end of the day, they're the people that push prices up. So there's this sort of thinking and insights and I guess showing what's going on underneath the surface that is what a really, really accomplished buyer's agent will do.
Right.
Now, from a sales agent perspective, and look, you know, there's these disruptors, and it's interesting, the Purple Bricks thing, I mean, I love that they call themselves a disruptor. I mean, they just basically were a cheap alternative, and they completely misunderstood how we buy, how we sell property in this country.
Okay.
Because they came in with an English model, and in the UK, agents, like owners often show their own properties in the UK.
Right, okay.
You know, owners don't show their own properties in Australia.
Okay. So in some degree, Purple Bricks was bringing the current business just a bit more online, whereas here they had to kind of break apart the entire business model. Is that
They didn't actually research the Australian market. Yeah. It was bizarre. It's like, oh, it's worked so well in the UK, we'll just bring it to Australia. they all speak English.
Yeah, right.
Must be the same, right?
Yeah.
Which astounds me with the amount of money they invested in it. But and Aaron, you know, so I don't see that really as a disruptor. But what is interesting is that I think a market is, or an industry is ripe for disruption if people don't trust them.
Yeah.
You know, if they want an alternative.
Yep,
the sales agent thing is different to the buyer's agent thing, because the buyer's agent thing is there's only still a very small percentage of people that actually use a buyer's agent because it's an additional fee.
Yep.
And so therefore they've got to have a different mindset themselves around why they need help. Mm. So we're not sort of ripe for disruption yet. But, you know, in a way we're sort of disrupting, but it's more the disrupting.
You are the disruption for now, right?
Well, we're sort of more the disrupting the buyer's mentality about how they actually go about it.
Right. What you mentioned owners and investors. How would you, what's your, I'm not asking a question that's giving away personal secrets, what proportion of your business is investors and what is owner occupiers? How do you kind of see that part of the market operating?
So at the market peak, our proportion was 60% owner-occupiers, 40% investors.
Yep.
That sort of dropped immediately to 70-30, and then it went down to 10-90.
Okay.
And so we're going back up again. I haven't actually checked my most recent numbers, but our 60-40 split for us works really well. Okay. I like that.
Makes sense.
And a lot of that is because we only, in my business, and I've got another sort of business where I'm starting, but that's permission to talk about it, but in my core business, which is Good Deeds Property Buyers, in Sydney, we buy within a 10K radius of the CBD. And so, you know, there's a lot of investors that come to us that simply don't have enough money to buy a quality investment.
Right.
If they can afford in Melbourne, I will refer them to people I know down there. Okay. But there's, you know, we can talk about what makes a quality investment in property.
I was going to get onto that, actually. Mm. So that was exactly my next question. I was going to ask you about what parts of the country you work in. You've answered that, 10Ks of the Sydney CBD. I guess I'll ask you why that. I mean, if someone's got money to spend and they want to buy 15Ks out, why would you say, no, I'm not going to help you, or I can't help you, or whatever? So maybe that first. And then maybe the answer is the same. What makes a great property investment? I know that's a very generic question, but let's start there. So why 10Ks of the CBD? And then and then I assume that's because it makes a great investment, or maybe it doesn't. But just give us an answer to that kind of question, if you could.
So fundamentally, it's because within that 10K radius, and look, there might be a little bit of flex in different edges of it, but the reality is A-grade property needs to be within 10K because there's scarcity in terms of location, in terms of actually supply, right?
Okay.
So, and then we get into the layers of what do you buy? Do you buy houses? Do you buy apartments? Do you buy new apartments? No, you don't. Do you buy, you know?
I'm going to ask you about that because I know you're hot on that one.
So that's sort of a very general thing. And the fundamental reason for that is that it's the whole ripple effect, you know, that people will go beyond those borders when the market is hot because of affordability, and then they contract within those borders again when the market becomes more affordable. And so there's always underlying demand for quality property in those areas.
So let me challenge that only because I don't understand. So you'll set me straight. If a market is relatively efficiently priced, generally speaking, isn't that premium already priced into those properties? If they are already high quality properties and they're going to be already selling for more, on one version of the future, you'd say, well, if everything's priced kind of roughly appropriately most of the time, then the opportunity for someone who's buying cheaper 15, 20Ks out, or someone who's buying more expensively 10Ks in, in theory, the future looks the same for both. If they're priced right now, then the future gains should be, in theory, somewhat similar, shouldn't they?
But they're not.
Tell me why.
The future gains, Well, because the reality is, and I've done loads of case studies on this, you can actually look in, say, within one suburb. You've got a median growth rate, right? Yes. Every suburb's got its median, which basically means you've got 50% going to perform above that median, 50% below.
Yep.
So not everything. A rising tide does not lift all ships, people. You know, and this is said a lot. A rising tide lifts all ships. So therefore, the market's going up, everything's going up. Isn't that wonderful? Actually, no.
Okay.
You can have people lose money in a rising market. You can have people make more money than others in a falling market.
Veronica, you're not allowed to say that. You're supposed to be working in property. Property goes up, it doesn't go down. Everything's okay.
And everything goes up 7% per annum, doesn't it? Yes, doubles in 10 years. You know, 7.2%, I should say.
Exactly.
But, you know, yeah, and this is the thing that, and this is why I love that you said you're not going to get Spruikers on, because they will come on and feed people this diet of bullshit. And sorry, am I allowed to say it again?
I already have, so you can, absolutely.
You know, and people lap it up. They love being told that crap.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one of the biases, right? We like confirmation bias. Mm. If you think property's going to go up, if you kind of feel comfortable with property because it's physical and you can touch all that kind of good stuff, is there a ceiling though? I mean, at some point, if inner city property goes up twice as fast as the rest of it, at some point, doesn't it price itself out of the market? Isn't there a point at which you're going to say, I can't do inside 10Ks anymore because it's just already, all the gains are already priced in? Or are there literally decades of kind of outperformance ahead for that inner city market?
It's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because you always think, and I've been now in real estate for 20 years, and you keep thinking, oh, it couldn't possibly be that a two-bedroom semi would sell for more than $300,000, you know?
who's paying that money, right?
Oh, my God. Exactly. And now that same two-bedroom semi might be working, you know, might be selling for one and a half, you know? It's...
Should have bought it back then. You didn't tell me.
Yeah, Why didn't I? Oh, I could have bought back then in the 1970s. But there's all these... But I think that, yes, there are points at which you go, oh, that's too much, you know, and so obviously that's when you get these corrections. But there's other factors that go into affordability, you know, you've got interest rates, you've got, you know, incomes, you've got a whole bunch of, you know, other stuff way beyond my capabilities of understanding. I'm looking at the doc because I'm presuming you can talk about all that sort of stuff. But all of that stuff drives what people can afford to pay.
Yeah.
Then you've got elitism because at the end of the day, you've got a scarcity issue, and who wants to live close to the city? Those that earn more money. Have more capacity to pay, and so that's going to be basically what underpins it.
So it is purely supply and demand at some level. I mean, you can't – it's very hard to add more houses in the Sydney eastern suburbs, for example. They're already built out around the foreshore. Maybe you can knock down a house and build a couple of villas. Maybe you can knock down a couple of villas and build a high-rise. But at some point, the ROI and that stuff starts to fall away. If you've got – 25 million, 30 million, 40 million Australians over time all wanting to live in the eastern suburbs, is that enough just to kind of create that demand that gives it that sort of market-beating growth in that area?
Well, it's certainly done that in the past.
Okay.
You know, and I can't foresee with population growth that it's going to change, really, because it's always going to be scarce. And every now and then you get one of those houses that knocked down and a duplex put on. Mm. That puts more scarcity on the remaining house. You know what I mean?
That's a good point. Okay, so I'm going to assume from that comment that you're saying that a freestanding house is the better of the investment options?
Well, and here's the thing too. So freestanding house in these sort of areas is a lot of money. So you are going to be sinking a lot of money into one asset.
Yep.
And that's where I'm not so, you know, I think if you can live in it, that's a different conversation.
Okay.
But to be running around thinking you have to buy houses because land is where the value is, and there's some myths in that as well, right? You know, that's a dangerous assumption to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I do fully believe that people should not only invest in property. Okay, so therefore I'm like, well, once you spend $2 million, for argument's sake, buying one asset, how much have you got left to invest?
How much
you got left to diversify? And your return in terms of your yield.
Yeah.
Now, I never buy for yield, ever, because you're not going to borrow that much money and take that much risk to buy for yield. Okay. Really, you can get yield doing other things, and I'm sure you can tell everybody how you can get yield.
We have some ideas.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, and that's why I actually point people to a financial planner and say, go to a financial planner who actually understands property but actually can talk to you about all the other ways that you can get yield into your portfolio rather than buying a property for yield because you are locking a lot of money away, a lot of borrowing capacity away on an asset that isn't necessarily going to grow in value. And that, to me, just is insane. So... back to the yield, if you're going to buy a really, you know, cracker asset, as in a $2 million house, for argument's sake, you might only get 2% yield on that.
It's not going to pay the bills.
It's not
going to pay the interest bill, more importantly.
And no, it won't pay the interest bill. Yeah. So you're going to be compensating for that out of your income.
Right.
And that might be your decision if you're early enough in your trajectory and you've got loads of, you know, you're going to become a surgeon or something, you're going to earn bucket loads, it might be a great thing to do.
Yeah.
But for most people, that is certainly not a smart thing to do.
All right, so you're not buying for yield, maybe you're not buying an expensive freestanding house, and you're not buying outside 10Ks from the Sydney CBD.
Trying not to. What
are you looking for? What makes for a good property investment inside those criteria?
Yeah, so look, some houses, yes, can be, and it may be that you, for an value-add investor, so someone who actually does want to actually do some renovations, for instance, at some point in the future, you know, a small semi-detached house, for argument's sake, in an inner-city suburb might be a great opportunity because you can buy it, you can sit on the lower yield and you can just suck that up for a bit of time. You're going to get some capital growth, and then you're going to have an injection of growth because you're going to inject and invest more in that. You don't have to pay stamp duty a second time around. You don't have to increase your land tax. And land tax is another reason that I hate the current land tax system. But, you know, so land tax is something that people buying freestanding or just Torrens Title houses on land have to contend with when they're investing. So, and that's a horrible, horrible bill that comes in every year, I know. So, you know, so if you're going to buy a house to add value to down the track, that can be a very successful thing to do. I like apartments, but nowhere near where you've got massive development. And definitely I don't like new apartments. I like small boutique apartments, you know, ideally with some level of scarcity. It might be Art Deco, it might be warehouse conversion, et cetera, et cetera. That's not to say we don't buy the red brick, you know, three-story walk-ups. We can do those in the right apartments, the right maintenance, the right type of building, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
And on the odd occasion, we do buy in a larger complex because that complex has certain unique characteristics that lend itself to being a really good investment. So we've got to sort of understand the principles of investment and then identify buildings and locations and apartments within those buildings as well that, you know, fulfil those criteria.
And that's the benefit of the expert. Like I'm a huge critic of overpriced financial advice, for example. I'm also a huge critic of overpriced property advice if you're not getting value from it. But if you can bring those things to bear, sometimes paying small percentages of purchase prices to avoid some of those traps, take advantage of some of the opportunities that an expert who works in this thing 24/7, you know, we all live in a house, so we all think we're experts.
Yes.
You go to the real estate catalog. I don't think they're around anymore. You jump online and you find a property. I can buy that. I know everything about that.
Yeah.
Those mistakes that maybe you wouldn't know unless you've been doing it regularly are the sort of things I guess a buyer's agent can bring to a buyer. For those who know Sydney, I assume you drive through Green Square with your eyes closed at the moment. Is that apartments and apartments built on top of apartments?
Yes.
I imagine you haven't bought anything there recently.
No, tend not to. And look, that's sort of interesting too because all that overdevelopment, you've got North Ryde, you've got Green Square, you've got Mascot, you've got all that stuff. That sort of gives me the heebie-jeebies, to be honest. It's like sort of the new generation suburbia. That gives me the heebie-jeebies too, just quietly. But
is that the equivalent of the new farms or the Docklands in the other cities?
Yeah,
Brisbane and Melbourne?
Yeah. I mean, look, they were ahead of us in terms of having overdevelopment.
It's true.
And certainly Sydney's now done a great job of adding to that.
We're best to catch up.
And well, yeah, it's sort of interesting too because it has actually had a ripple effect in terms of rental yields as well in far-flung suburbs. You know, I've been speaking to property managers, say, in Bondi, and, you know, you're seeing the impact where some tenants are going, oh, I'm not going to rent an old apartment in Bondi. I'm actually going to go and rent something brand new in Mascot and I'll get some sort of discount, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a while for that to you know, absorb into the market.
Its way out. Yeah, right, exactly. Are there other things that you are specifically avoiding? So you've talked about the big overdevelopment. You've talked about potentially paying too much for a single building you're not going to get a return from. Is there a don't buy checklist?
Yeah, look, I'll tell you what. I think seriously there's probably 5 to 10% of property that we would seriously consider looking at and advising a client on. Like there's a lot.
So 19 out of 20 property sales this weekend are going to be bad deals for the buyer.
That's
phenomenal. Mm. Are there any, can you give us a couple of things to avoid in that
main roads, main roads. People buy main roads when it's a hot market, and it's a hot market now in Sydney and Melbourne. As I think some CoreLogic data came out very recently showing the growth trajectory since the election. Something like 12% has been added to median house price.
That's phenomenal.
In both each city. You know, so FOMO kicks in. People go, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, I got
left
behind.
Did we just do this?
Yeah. We've just been through this. Everyone's got short memories. Okay, should have bought in 2018, everybody, but you're all sitting on your hands going, I want to wait and see what the market does, and now you can know.
The market's too hot, I'm not buying. Then the market's falling, I'm not buying. Now it's back to the market's
like,
too hot, I'm not buying.
What are you waiting for? So here they all are back in fully fledged, all ready to go.
Yep.
And now's the time when people start really compromising on things that you can't fix. You can't fix the main road.
Right, okay.
Can't fix it.
Yep.
There's certain situations where you've got houses, like some terraces, for instance, where they're really, really narrow and skinny and you've got nothing you can do about it. You've got steep staircase, 45-degree staircase. You can never get a bathroom upstairs, for instance.
Right, of course.
You know, stuff like that is fundamentally irritating. Mm. People will overlook when the market's hot, and when the market's flat, they will pick it to pieces and they won't touch it.
Yeah, nice. I can't saw a piece of wood straight. So full disclosure. Is there really enough benefit? I've always looked at renovating. You look at those houses, I'd love to fix that one up. But then I think, by the time I've done it and wasted the time and spent the money and paid for a builder's or you know, a handyman's margin and then all that kind of stuff, is there enough upside in buying to renovate? Is that just kind of one of those pipe dreams everyone thinks they can do?
Yeah.
Is it worth doing?
Sometimes. Look, okay. The reality is most people overestimate their abilities and they underestimate the cost. And, you know, there's people making a fortune in these, you know, how to renovate courses and
right,
stuff like that.
Right. And TV shows and all that kind of stuff. How hard can it be? 100 grand here just for the taking,
oh,
right?
Oh, no. When they give you these little, you know, these little rules of thumb, like, you know, you should never spend more than, I don't know, what's 2% of the value on your kitchen or whatever it is. And they don't work. You know, because some properties shouldn't be renovated.
Right.
You know, some like those little skinny terrace, for instance. Yeah, you can go put a beautiful new kitchen and bathroom in that. But if those rooms are in the wrong part of the house and you can't actually, without substantial expense, rejig the floor plan, then that's not a quick and dirty reno. You know, so if the floor plan's right and you're just basically fixing up a few things, you can do one. But, you know, not every property is equal in that regard.
It makes sense. Now, speaking of that, new developments.
Mm.
So a couple of things. One of the things that's always stuck with me from our conversation, I think it was one of the podcasts I was listening to previously, prior to being on your podcast, Elephant in the Room, by the way.
Oh,
so listeners, have a look for that. You talked about the whole, you know, only one left kind of thing on new development, right? And the marketing is really clear. It's the old era of, oh, you've got to get in now because they're almost gone. And you're creating that fear of missing out that we always talk about. I don't want to be the last one in. And you made the point, that means people have preferred every single other unit or prop development in the place. This is the least popular. This is the one no one else wants to buy. So when they say only one left, got to get in.
The dregs.
You're saying, why would you buy the one no one else has already wanted?
Yeah.
And I've got to say, I felt a bit stupid when I heard that because I'm like, of course that's true.
Yeah.
But I'd fallen for the marketing.
Well, I mean, we all do. I mean, because at the end of the day, until you challenge on it, you go, oh, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, we all do it. I know some developers actually say, oh, this is the marketing suite. You know, but the reality is they move the furniture from one property to another throughout
There's
it, you know, if it's built. Yeah. So it's like, oh, yeah, it's the marketing suite because it's the last one you own.
Yeah.
But I think if you are going to buy a new development, really, it's got to – I personally don't do it for investing.
Right.
If you're going to do it as an owner-occupier, there's a lot of due diligence that you need to do. Right. I think that really in recent times we've had some pretty stark reminders just how lax our whole system is in terms of, you know, build quality.
And again, not to over-promote your podcast, but you've also had some people on recently talking about some of that stuff, which is really – if you're going to buy a new development, I guess A, Veronica would probably say don't do it, but B, if you're going to and you're not going to listen to that advice – at least listen to the episode. I don't remember the lady's name, but you had a lady on who was talking about some of the tips and traps and just some of the things to be really, really careful of.
We've had a number. I mean, you know, with a conveyancer, for instance, around the contract, that was Jenny Tonner. And then we also in interviewed Karen Stiles. She's the executive officer of the
Karen's
Owners Corporation Network,
OCN.
And oh my God, that was just an enlightening episode.
We've had a really bad way.
And we've interviewed engineers, you know, we've really had some very interesting conversations about this.
Yeah, okay, nice one. Let me kind of go to just lay out for people very quickly. They can listen to your podcast and get more. Why don't you prefer to buy in new developments? What are the traps? What are the reasons you shouldn't be doing that?
Well, I think the build quality probably is number one. You know, just the element of risk. And for me, it is all about risk. I like to minimize risk when you're buying property. It's so much money, so much borrowing. As I said, you know, it's great that you can leverage. That's a wonderful thing about property. The ability
only on the upside there, right?
the ability to leverage, but that's only if you get yourself a good asset.
Right.
So what the problem is with a lot of these new builds is that they're built as investor stock.
Right.
And as opposed to investor grade. And these are terms that you will hear bandied around. A lot of spruikers use them as well. but the principle behind investor grade is that fundamentally it's going to go up in value. The principle behind investor stock is it's been developed to flog to unsuspecting investors. And I use the word investors with rabbit's ears around it because you're not investing if you're buying a piece of crap that's going to lose money.
Yeah.
You're actually hoping for the best. So you're doing a bit of wishful thinking. And so this stuff has been developed and there's no scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
You've got potential issues with build quality. You've also got the fact that you're paying a premium at the outset.
Mm.
So you're going to lose capital value for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many of these buildings that are the beginning of a whole massive big development. And so you got to understand that you're at the beginning, then you may not get capital growth for another 10 years until they're finished.
It's a long time.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many reasons, really. And that's just tip of the iceberg.
Yes, I can imagine. Now, I will again reference one of your episodes, because one I particularly liked, and again, I can't remember the gentleman's name. I should have done a bit more work on this one. But
I'll remind you.
Thank you. You had one guest I'll talk about, and you had a property Dumbo section, which I'll talk about as well. But you asked for this particular gentleman's property Dumbo, and he talked about I think it might have been a friend of his. Maybe it was him. He was just pretending it was a friend.
Yeah.
But who bought a property off the plan.
Mm-hmm.
That had a coffee table in the middle of the lounge room
on the floor plan, yeah.
Which was wonderful. And you think, great, a coffee table, that's nice they put that feature in. Turned out, what was it?
A column.
So in the middle of his lounge room, he's got a supportive column holding the place up.
Yeah.
That in theory he's got to look around to see the TV. He looked at the plan and went, oh, coffee table, that's cool. And frankly, the builder was probably, I don't know if you said who it was, so I won't make allegations that get me in trouble. In any case, they could have been more clear. By the same token, it wasn't, you know, a floor plan is a top-down look. You're looking down and that's a column and that's there. They could have been a little bit clearer in describing what it was.
Maybe.
But again, one of those things about you buy off the plan, you think that's what you're getting.
Well, a lot of people can't read plans.
Right, right.
So, you know, I see properties. It's interesting too. I mean, you know, I like to look at a plan and I think, oh, that's really weird. Couldn't you have done it that way? It would have been better, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people don't get it. And also, when you're buying off the plan, you'll notice there's not any dimensions on those rooms.
Ah.
So, you know, visually,
what's the trap there?
Well, the room could be very, very small. you know, I mean, what often happens is you sit down, you look at plans side by side, and we do this when we're doing pricing research of properties, and I always make the team print the plan off, and I know it's wasting a few, you know, trees. Actually work out the dimensions for the room. This is very manual and boring. If anyone's got this really great way to automate this, please tell me. But put the dimensions down and really lay them down. How much total living is in that property? How much bigger the bedrooms, etc. So with your plans, it's really easy to be hoodwinked by just looking at something and not understanding it.
It's the equivalent of putting the really tiny munchkin bed in the bedrooms, right, when someone's selling a place. Wow, there's so much space in this bedroom. There's this little tiny bed.
They take the feet off. there are styler tricks.
Take the feet. But there's also, they seem like actual, literally smaller beds, are they, or is it just
they
visual?
They use doubles, right, so they can call it a double bedroom. But actually, when we were filming once in Melbourne, I remember telling some contributors to the show, we were looking at an apartment in Melbourne, and I was telling them a story about how they use these little beds and they take the feet off and it makes the room look bigger. I said, look, and I go to show them in this particular apartment we were in, and I lifted up the sheet, you know, the doona and that sort of stuff, and discovered that the bed was actually a pile of boxes that made a bed out of. Imagine if someone sat on it.
That's brilliant. Saves a few dollars on the styling, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. No wheels on that bed, I can tell you.
That's right. That helps. Solves that problem. No wheels to take off. All right. Now, let me go back to the psychology. The elephant in the room again. The idea is the psychological tips and tricks.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about a couple already. What are a couple of other favourites of yours that you suggest buyers be careful of, maybe even sellers be careful of,
when
it comes to buying and selling real estate?
So, yeah, our first episode, you know, our foundational episode was with Simon Russell, who's a behavioural scientist in the finance field. And so he went off to his first ever auction and comes back and says, oh, my God, there's all these biases. It's really fantastic. So our first episode is all about that.
Excellent.
One of the ones that I find interesting is consistency bias.
Okay.
So once you've started something, then you feel compelled to continue doing it.
Yeah.
And Simon,
you find excuses to do it, right?
Well, yeah, and Simon used the word, we don't want to appear capricious, and I think that's such a good word, because it's like, you know, at the end we do something and we don't want to look fickle, we don't want to look stupid, don't want to look like we were wasting somebody's time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you made that first offer and you're in.
Yeah.
And often people do that. They haven't really actually considered what next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that happens at auction too.
Okay.
I've seen it happen. I love going to auctions even when they're not bidding because I really watch what is going on in people's faces and their body language and everything. And they've started bidding and then, oh, hadn't really thought about what if it goes over that price? Am I prepared to pay it or not? And then you see couples arguing in the middle of an auction. This is not the time, guys, to work out what your maximum bid is on that property.
Right.
So that consistency bias is rather interesting.
That's
and certainly in auctions you see it a lot because the auctioneer wants to play on that.
Yeah. There's a couple of edges for what it's worth. I think for companies, in particular, mergers and acquisitions have the same kind of issue.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're considering a merger, you kind of find a way to make it happen, right? You kind of, once you start that process, the M&A team are already on board and you're already considering it. One of the interesting, I don't know if this applies to property, one of the interesting things that that behavioral scientists recommend is have at least another idea on the table.
Ah,
so you're comparing
yeah.
the two and choosing the best one. If you're saying, should we buy company X or should we invest in this particular merger acquisition, you find a reason to say yes because there's people who are justifying their job and you're considering it and you want to weigh it up and no one wants to think the time is wasted, exactly to your point. Having a second option, either do nothing or how about this one instead, it makes you do that comparison job of, actually, is this the right thing to be doing? So that's interesting, I find, from an investing perspective.
Yeah,
from,
so you don't get that tunnel vision.
Exactly. Mm. The other thing is, you mentioned investor-grade investor stock, and just another parallel. That, to me, sounds a bit like the bottom end of the share market, right? Mm. So investor stock is the dodgy biotech or specky miner, right, that basically its business is getting money from shareholders rather than actually going and doing the mining. So that's the investor stock one. That's the, hey, if we list this thing, maybe people will buy the shares, and maybe we can raise some more money. I don't think it's outright fraud, although sometimes it is. Mm. It's more just that idea of, you know, that's the investor stock. That's the, if we can convince enough people for long enough, maybe eventually we'll strike it rich. If we don't, no skin off our nose. If we do, we make a fortune.
Wow.
Investor grade then is the reverse, which is literally, is this company worth buying? And like you with property at the Motley Fool, we try and make sure that we're recommending investor grade stuff, not just things that are out there because investors might possibly buy them, which is, unfortunately, again, I'm not sure if it's 9 out of 20, but it's probably not far off in the stock market. There's a whole lot of rubbish out there that's simply not worth buying. I think
interesting.
That's probably
good parallel.
A good comparison. Yeah, exactly.
And that feeds into the sunk cost bias as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, because, and this is what happens with property buyers, and once they've spent money on their building pests and having the contract reviewed and that sort of stuff.
Yep,
and
we
have to watch it in our business, you know, just because we've done all this evaluation on the property, you know, one of our KPIs is, how many properties have we actually told our clients not to go for?
That's cool.
Because it's like once we uncover something, it's like just because you've done all that, rule line in the sand, thank you for the fact that now we know we shouldn't be touching it.
Yeah.
You know,
I wonder if I was a real estate agent, I was going to be dodgy and I wouldn't do either of those things necessarily, but I wonder if I'd do some sort of deal with cut price property and building and pest inspections, right? For exactly that reason. Just get people started on that path so they feel like they're in on that one.
Oh, they 100% do. There's these ones where you can, and I'm not saying all of these are dodgy, but there some are, where you can get a building and pest, you only pay, say, $49, and if you buy the property, you pay the rest of it. so it gets you into that.
Totally, right?
Yeah,
just get over those first obstacles and get people on that conveyor belt.
Yeah.
I've got a bugbear. You've already dispelled my property should all go up at the same price and be roughly efficiently priced. So I'll give that one up.
Nice idea.
I want to hit you with another one. The whole auction strategy thing. Now you've just written a book about auction ready. So I'm either going to completely pulp the book after this, or you're going to convince me I'm wrong. So one or the other is going to happen.
Mm.
I find that the idea of auction strategy, at least on the surface, to be a bit hard to take, right?
Mm.
If I know how much if the three of us are at an auction, you, me and Doc, we're all going to go and we know what our limits are within some degree of reason.
Mm.
Where one of us is going to buy, probably the one with the highest limit, given the circumstances more often than not.
Mm.
Whether I go first or last, whether I make a killer bid or I don't, isn't the property still going to go to the person who simply has the most money to spend on this particular property on the day? Is there really a strategy that actually can change the outcome? I would have thought, generally speaking, that you can almost write your limits down on a piece of paper before the auction. You just take the top one, call the whole thing off, and not worry with the theatre. Does it actually make a difference, or is it just we all feel better because, again, the psychological biases, I've added some value, I have a strategy, somehow I'm winning this game, when at the end of the day it's just like, who's got the most buying power?
Look, yes and no. I think what you're saying a lot of the time is true. The person with the deepest pockets will buy the property.
Right, right.
The auction strategy is a bit like having a birth plan. Now, I'm a woman, so I've given birth. I guess you guys haven't.
No,
but have you got wives that have
yes,
given
ma'am.
Birth? Right, okay. So, you know, the whole birth plan thing and you write it all out and it's like, oh, that's good because, you know, I'm in total control here. What a lot of cod's wallet, do you know? And So the auction strategy thing and the book, in the book, I don't think I've actually written about auction strategies, interestingly enough. I hope I haven't used that word now. I think I'm saying this because...
Buy the book next week and find out whether Veronica has included
and if
strategy.
I have you. Send it back and I'll give you your money back.
There you go. So, there's an offer.
But so the reality is you've got to understand what's likely to happen at the auction. You've got to have sort of some tools in your kit bag and some strategy or tactics, not strategies, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's look at tactics differently. The strategy is, well, I've decided I want to buy that property and I have to go to auction. Yep. That's sort of the strategy,
right,
isn't it, really?
That's pretty clear.
The tactics are, okay, well, so we go to auction, I've got to work out how much money I'm going to spend on that property and I'm going to stress test that limit before I go to auction. That's the thing that most people don't do, and that's the reason there is flex in terms of it's not always the person with the deepest pockets that buys the property.
Explain that in a bit more detail for us.
Okay, so people who go and have set their limit before and really understand exactly how far they'll go and push themselves even a little bit beyond that so they know what their walk-away price is.
Yep.
They can bid differently to somebody who's gone with a wishful thinking price. And then is it the BAFTA it's called, you know, the best alternative, whatever. When you're in negotiation, there's So where they'll go to basically if they're in momentum, if they've got the consistency bias happening and they've already bid and they've started bidding or they're lulled into the momentum or they're sucked in or they're trying to compete with that guy over there.
Right.
That stuff happens at auctions.
Okay.
So I'm looking, okay, I know what my limit is. I'm looking at the crowd and I'm thinking, how can I bid in a way that's going to disrupt this and hopefully give me and my client an opportunity and an advantage, right? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
And the advantage here is basically stopping someone else getting carried away and overbidding.
Yeah. So I've had people say to me after auction, I don't know how you did it, but you got me to stop before my limit. Now that
nice,
to me
okay.
is like high five. Can I just record you saying that?
And can I have half the difference,
yeah,
please?
Yeah. Please.
How much did I save?
Go back to my client. Hey, did you hear that? So it does happen.
Okay.
It can happen. You can outpsych people, but you can't use the same method every time. You know, okay. I have actually pissed buyers off. I have. I was at an auction recently and the auctioneer even, I just went, oops, I've upset him, haven't I? And the auctioneer laughed because he knows me and he went, oh, you might have, you know. And so you've got to be careful. There are certain ways that you can play it. The thing is, though, if I look like I've got bottomless pockets and that freedom within the fence or running to the cliff or that sort of stuff, if I look like I'm never going to stop, there are times that I can use that to actually stop somebody else.
Okay.
And the other thing, too, is what I don't do is do the typical thing where you start big bids and you go smaller, smaller, smaller until in the end you're doing bids in thousands and they can go for $100,000 in one. Look at my wife, look at my husband, all this stuff gets drawn out forever.
Right.
They're in it. Right?
Right.
Whereas you go in, oh, look, bugger this is going to go on forever. I know there's $100,000 to be added to it. I'm going to go, no, I'll give you 13 or something like that. So you can circumvent and stop that hypnosis effect, during auction.
And that the idea is there that stops the other people going on top of that because it feels like such a big bid, they feel like they're not going to win it? Is that what
gets
them to...
Well, they get snapped out of that reverie or whatever they're in, you know, because they do think 1,000, that person struggled, maybe my next 1,000 will actually buy it, you know, so it doesn't feel too much. They've forgotten that, you know, it's, you know, there's... 2 million and whatever, but they're going, one, you know.
$2 million and $12,000 and 55 cents.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the idea of that is that it kind of knocks out allows your client to buy for a cheaper price because you knock the other guy out, or you simply just don't make sure your current client's not overbidding in the same kind of scenario. Are there two sides of that?
We don't want to play a part in sort of bidding that we know is not really in our client's best interest.
Mm-mm.
So, we're trying to stop it.
Nice. I'll ask you a couple of theoretical questions now. Mm. Some topics I know you're pretty passionate about. You mentioned land tax already. So I'm going to ask you about that. Let's bundle the taxes up. Mm. So I know you guys were pretty strident pre-election about the negative gearing and the capital gains tax changes. Mm. You've also talked about land tax. So just if I made you treasurer for a day, I'm not going to because I'm getting that job if it's up, but assume I'm going to give you the option. What's the right structure? Because I know you're not a spruik. You're not here for just what's the best for highest possible property prices. What's the best structure when it comes to property taxation, including things like negative gearing and capital gains?
Yeah, and look, I am not an expert in this area, and I literally have sort of some half-formed views. So I'm best to just give you my half-formed views and say, if I went,
that's what we do every week. The listeners are used to that.
If I was treasurer for a day, I'd be frigging diabolical. We interviewed Brendan Coates about this as well, which was quite interesting. But so the negative gearing thing first. Starters, like what really got me on that was that it wasn't called the capital gains tax, you know, policy.
Yes,
it was called the negative gearing tax policy.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what? You're able to negative gear other assets, other investments.
Mm-hmm.
Really, why should we be pulling that out of property and saying you can't do it with property? So I don't see that as being fair. I also, when you looked at the statistics and the proportion of people actually using negative gearing, it's actually skewed towards the lower income earners anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, most of my clients, I say, you know, does it bother you? And go, well, we don't even worry about negative gearing.
Right,
it's not a reason for us buying property. So I don't believe you should be buying property for tax breaks.
Amen.
So therein lies, well, then in reality, I go, oh, well, you shouldn't have negative gearing because it encourages people, and with this whole depreciation thing, and encourages the spruikers, and they just bang on about it. So in a way, it's bad.
Yeah.
It was going to be worse under Labor because it was only going to be available on new property.
Right.
So that was just diabolical.
It's about pushing people towards new developments.
Oh, just shocking. It's bad enough as it is. And yeah, that just made it worse, right?
Cut another couple of high rises and the place is already
Yeah. You can hear the spruikers now. Woo-hoo! Yeehaw! So that, in terms of the negative gearing sort of part of it, the capital gains tax concession is an interesting one because that is, I think that's too generous.
So Labor was talking about halving that from a 50% discount to a 25% discount. And you're in favour of that change?
Well, I'm not necessarily not in favour of it. I think that needs to be looked at, absolutely. Right. And whether that's the right number or not, I don't know. But certainly, you know, if you look back to when the capital gains tax concession was changed by the Howard government, well, we had 8% inflation. You know, it was a different... money was going up at a different rate. It was a different landscape. And it was putting to simplify things because trying to work out what the concession should be before then was a bloody nightmare.
I remember the back page of the Business Review Weekly, the old magazine, for those who aren't old enough to remember that. You're not, Veronica, you're too young, but Doc and I remember that. You actually had the capital gains tax index, the indices from each year, right? So if you bought the property in 1982, you had to apply this factor for sale to calculate the capital gains tax because it was indexed to inflation back in the day. That was done away with and the 50% arbitrary discount put in. I'm kind of with you a little bit. I don't necessarily see that unearned income in that frame should be taxed any more lightly than earned income. If I work for something, I've got to pay a higher tax than if I buy something and flog it off 5 years later for a profit. I don't necessarily see why that makes sense.
Yeah.
On the flip side, I also get the idea that paying tax on inflation also doesn't seem particularly like it should be. You know, it's kind of, that's the cost of living, right? Mm. So pay tax on that just because it's gone up also seems unreasonable.
Yeah.
But an arbitrary number, either way, I think, to my mind, is a bit, it's kind of, I don't know if it's a better solution. It's absolutely simpler, much less complex. But if you were to buy an asset, sell it 12 months and one day later, you're paying half the tax. If you hold that for 25 years, it's actually possible you would have been better off under the old inflation indexing scheme because you hold it for the long term. Inflation was larger than that.
Yeah.
And so you kind of, it was this arbitrary one where it actually, in theory, it's a long-term discount, but it's not really. It's like a year and a bit discount, which is much bigger.
Yeah.
The longer you go, the less attractive it actually is. So it actually disincentivises super long-term holding periods.
Yeah, look, I agree. I actually am in favour more of an annual index.
Right,
because
I just
think that's realistic.
Yes, yes.
You know, but I do think 50% is too generous and I'm happy to take it. Hey.
That's right, exactly.
But I just was really interested that wasn't pitched as the capital gains tax policy.
It hardly got talked about.
Yeah,
it was all about negative gearing. Yeah.
And that was really the thing that investors should be more worried about, to be quite frank. Yes. So it was just sort of that whole spin thing that really just annoyed the crap out of me.
I could tell listening to the podcast you're a little bit annoyed.
You know, it's got a bit riled. I mean, I hate stupidity. And that to me just seems so obvious. And then, you know, so in terms of land tax, look, I find land tax the way it is just really unfair.
Tell us why.
Well, it's a bit like the window tax is it the tulip tax? Or, I mean, it's just, it's a bit arbitrary, right? Okay. For starters, you don't have to earn any income to pay the tax.
Right.
So it's always like a tax on being wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not attached to anything.
That's a bit.
I'm
with you. Not to agree for the sake of it, but I always find it difficult to tax something that doesn't actually have a cash flow attached.
Yeah.
So to have to sort of carve off a section of a fixed asset.
Yeah.
To pay a tax seems a little bit unreasonable to me for that reason. It seems like, you know, if you're renting it out, fine. If you're doing something with it, if it's giving you a dividend income or cash savings account, something coming to you, take a slice of that makes sense. To have to divvy up the farm and take an acre off here and an acre off there or the property, whatever it is, just never made particular sense to me.
It's also, if you look at it from an investment point of view, okay, so you could say you got your $2 million, say, or $1 million even.
Yeah.
You got $1 million house on land and you're paying whatever land tax is on that versus you got $1 million apartment in a great area and you're paying a much smaller percentage of land tax.
Yes.
It might even be a better asset.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know,
just because
Yeah, yeah, and so it just seems very arbitrary in terms of, you know, it's choosing a particular type of wealth.
Yes.
As well. And I'm just uncomfortable with it.
And our listeners will know that was my argument. I don't know about Docs. I've been more strident on it because I'm just generally that sort of person. Docs are much more casual and laid back than I am. I listen to Tesla, as our
economists think land tax is very fair.
Docs a computer science PhD, so I'm not sure what computer science PhDs think. But from a, you know, the same thing with the franking credits, right? People taking that away and saying you should pay more tax on earnings because it happens to be shares rather than property or cash in the bank or art or anything else.
Yeah.
Again, that arbitrary kind of just pick an asset class and tax it differently because it happens to be a different asset class.
Mm.
Just seems to go against all kind of basic fairness or just pure,
it's
you know.
It's a bit political.
Doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
It's a bit sort of, you know, tall poppy-ish and all that sort of stuff. And, I think you should pay tax. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at Greece as a country that people don't like paying tax. It doesn't do well for the economy, right? So we've got to pay tax.
Yeah. The more tax you pay, it means you've made more money.
Well,
that's kind of a nice
thing
too, right?
You know, I'm quite happy to have a whopping great tax bill.
It'd be the best problem in the world.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
I will pay as much tax as I possibly can.
Please.
Exactly. We're not getting much disagreement here. Doctor, you've been quiet. Is that because you agree or because you disagree?
Can't get a word in.
There was that too.
I actually agree with the policy of I actually dislike negative gearing like anything.
Okay.
And the reason I think is exactly the reason you pointed out is negative gearing is provided to the group that is the most vulnerable, right? And, you know, as property prices go up and as debt to disposable income ratios increase, that's the group that's most vulnerable, right? Mm. So if something happens, the people with negative gearing are the ones who are going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And they will be the middle class, lower middle class, whatever you want to call it, the hardworking people, right? Mm. Not the rich ones.
No.
They probably can't afford, right?
Ones trying to replace income with property.
So I was actually in favor of, you know, I would just get rid of negative gearing altogether because negative gearing
for everything?
For everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for everything. It just doesn't make sense because it's, you know, who's it really helping, right? Are we helping... if we are helping people to invest who can't invest in that large an asset, they shouldn't be investing in that large an asset, right? That's my belief. Maybe you start small and you grow slowly. It just appears to be an outsized risk. I don't have an opinion about land taxes. I mean, I have an actual opinion about stamp duty. Repair property. That I think is a government mechanism that encourages property flipping. So I would basically say keep land tax and get rid of stamp duty altogether.
So you're saying stamp duty encourages property flipping?
No, stamp duty encourages government policies for property flipping.
Right.
Because I want the revenue. Right?
Because that's a huge income, right? So stamp duty is very, very... I have a number of things I could say. So stamp duty is very, it's a very Australian thing, right, to property, right? Land tax is applied in a lot of different places, basically, right? So you could look at land tax as another form of taxation in that sense, right? And, you know, people could pay income tax, I guess, and we could get rid of, you know, people could pay more income tax, which would address Scott's question, and we could get rid of. But stamp duty by design puts the state at an incentive to cause more property flippings, right? So, I mean, even if we wanted to make property affordable, we could just release more land.
Although the thing is with stamp duty, it's a disincentive for people to flip property because of the cost.
I agree. And that, I'm actually between the both of you because I've written about this years ago, actually. I agree with you, Veronica, in that sense. But to Doc's point, there is also that kind of the extra incentive, right? So you think about who's incentivizing what? The individual buyer is disincentivizing.
So I'll give you an example.
There's a lot of government benefits in property development, fundamentally, the actual buyer, the ultimate buyer is wearing, it's got the basically, was it the whole... countries on the built on the sheep's back or something, Australia in the past, and now it's like basically the country's built on the back of individual buyers of brand new apartments, and that's they're carrying the risk.
So I'll give you an example. I live in the West, right? Now, if I'm a developer, if I'm government policy, I would not go out and first. You're from Sydney, I'm assuming. So you know, I would not go first out and build Oran Park and put 200,000 or 50,000, whatever number of homes, leave the middle between that and Sydney empty, right? Why would I build so far out first and then leave all this empty, right? The reason behind that is, you know, I can build that, move people there, then build infrastructure, and then I can, you know, sell the middle part for more.
For more money. Yeah.
So I think if we were interested in...
You are cynical.
Yeah, I'm very cynical.
He really, really is.
if I'm being logical, then I would say that, you know, if the policy here encouraged, because that's a lot of revenue, the policy is designed to attract revenue, not actually to design to create affordability, right? Affordability is actually useful for people.
Yeah, although the problem is then they give first home buyers incentives, and those are mostly stamp duty incentives, and then they're encouraged to buy, you know, your brand new home out at Oran Park.
But that all works, you know, so that's all part of the scheme, right?
So they're basically fodder for the machine, saying.
It's all part of the spin wheel, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's what was my final thing. Oh, and I absolutely dislike auctions. So I think as a mechanism, it is one which again bids up prices because, you know, you put a bunch of people in a room and it seems like...
The thing is though, market forces will push prices up if there's demand for property. And I can tell you, even in a private treaty negotiation, if there is more than one person interested in a property, there'll still be an auction. It just won't be as transparent as a public auction. So that's something to be very, very aware of if you want to buy property in an area where there is scarcity.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll give you an example, personal example. So as immigrants, when you first land here, and you actually look to rent a property.
Yeah.
And you go to these open houses, okay? First, you'll be scared because you'll have 15, 20 families show up for one place.
Yeah, that is freaky.
That is very freaky, yes. Right? And
other immigrants, I'm presuming, given your accent, that this is your experience. But so are you finding other people like you or a mix?
A lot of diverse mix. You know, a lot of people are going to be like, you know, what is going on? Mm. Like, because, you know, I've rented apartments in other places, you know, in Canada. You just basically call up the guy, hey, I want to rent. And they said, yeah, come, when do you want to see
that
it?
Easy. Wow.
And then you just sign up and then, you know, you basically get it. There is enough supply and there's no... this fear psychosis that goes on, right? Mm. So there is something funny that's going on here.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but there is something unique.
Interesting.
And anything that is unique to me is weird.
Yeah, pretty cool. How long ago was this? Only because the rental market's been falling in Sydney the last 12 months or so.
So this was many, this was in 2008.
Okay, yes.
But the same thing with property buying too, right? I mean... in a lot of places, you basically list your property. People basically call the agent. Property stays listed for like months and months. There's no auction.
Don't go investing in those areas, people.
No, but I'm talking about other...
Your demand, right?
No, yeah. I'm talking about countries. I'm talking about general policy or as a... This is more of a policy level question, right?
Yeah.
There are places where you could basically just walk up and buy stuff, but here you can't, right?
Yeah.
And that's very unique. I think it goes back to your comment about the market being very unique and
it is.
You know, and appreciating the uniqueness. But I think some of those things are policy driven as well.
It's just my comment. Look, and I do think what you're saying is there's a lot in that. That's very true. My sister lives in Italy, so I often have these conversations with my brother-in-law around the differences, you know, and it took me many, many years to understand that Australia is quite unique in this regard because he's saying, well, there is no property market. Prices don't rise. What do you mean by that? Well, there must be people looking around to buy a property and it's like, well, they don't. Basically, somebody will own a property and it's been in the family for maybe even centuries and decades or whatever. And it's if they might be enticed to sell, and it really comes down to a negotiated deal between two people just because somebody's decided they want to sell rather than having an active property market.
That's interesting.
It's really different. And so,
So I think that's where I think policy comes in. So the largest data for property market goes back to, I think, Amsterdam.
Mm.
History, if you look at 200 years, the property market rises by 3%. So there's a question to ask as to why should Sydney be any different from Amsterdam, right? Then the answer probably lies in policy, right? And I think the answer is really policy, because otherwise it should not be anything different. If you think about it, you know, I mean, Amsterdam is, you know, it's basically...
Was it growing in terms of population?
Those are policy questions, right? Is it growing? How fast is it growing? How fast is, you know... land being released. You can make an argument for a place like Netherlands that place is basically sinking in water, right?
Wouldn't be buying there either.
but technically then there's, you know, there is a scarcity of land there as well. We have no scarcity of land, actually, technically, as a country. It's a large country. You know, so that's policy good.
I've seen Mad Max. This can definitely work, guys.
So this is all policy good. Anyways, that's my viewpoint.
That's good. That's a good one. Now, Veronica, I can't let you go because our listeners will be clamoring if I don't ask you.
Uh-huh.
You focus on Sydney, so let's make it a Sydney question. We can't and we shouldn't extrapolate. I think what I like about your approach is that it's really funny. Again, talking about the difference between shares and property people. Shares people say, well, I like this company or that company. Mm. And then tends to, for a decent subset of our group, say, but property is X, right? Mm. So there's a single market. And you guys have said many, many times, Eliza Rowan said the same thing, there is not one property market. There's an average, of course, like yeah. the share market. But there's not one market. There are different pockets, different opportunities.
Mm.
You've talked about city CBD, then there's suburban, there's other cities, there's yeah. regional, rural. Based on where you are, what are you seeing in the Sydney CBD-ish, whatever you call that kind of 10-kilometre radius, what are you seeing in the market right now? How are prices going? How are buyers and sellers reacting? what's the mood? And frankly, where are the opportunities or are there opportunities? Should you be buying or selling? Give us the quick market summary.
Yeah, sure, sell.
All right.
Look, there's FOMOs back in.
Yeah.
Supply and demand. Fundamentally, that's the one thing that drives property in this country is supply and demand. I mean, it might be impacted by policy and, you know, the rest of it, but at the end of the day, it is supply and demand.
Right.
So there's high demand, low supply. That's been well documented. There's also a bit of a change in the way agents are actually marketing properties. So there's a perception of lower supply than there probably really is, and only because what agents are doing now is, you know, they've got sort of a scarcity mindset going on, and so they're sort of changing their pitch to potential vendors and going, oh, well, let's do it off-market first.
Oh, right.
So there is an increasing amount of property that is being
That's
sold off-market. So there's this, and, you know, I've always said, look, you know, when the market gets hot, the off-markets die off, and they normally always have in the past.
Okay.
However, it's these agents sort of changing their sales approach that's affecting that. So,
just
yes.
Why would you as an agent not want the maximum possible competitive tension? Why would you go for an off-market sale?
I don't really. It's basically to get a listing. Pitching their database. They're pitching to say, look, you know.
Right.
And look, owners do like the idea of going, oh, that means I don't have to paint it. I don't have to style
clean
it.
Clean up. Have people come tramping in my house.
Exactly right.
Yeah,
and
I get
for weeks. One poor mug who's been looking for a bit longer than everybody else, and they'll pay more than everyone else.
Which,
and,
if it was true, you'd take, right?
You know,
I'd absolutely. Someone
and
to walk in my house
happens.
And pay me over the odds.
And sometimes it happens. But, you know, I bought one property last year, April, May, I think I bought it, and I'd seen it the December the previous year for $800,000 more than we bought it for.
Wow.
So, you know, there's often a premium on these off-market stuff. So in what's happening, yes, there's FOMO, there's this perception, real or otherwise, that there's no stock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality is there's never enough quality stock anyway. This is something we deal with day in, day out. You know, it's like for us, it's just Groundhog Day, but for the average buyer who enters the market and they're seeing and they're reading the papers and all that sort of stuff, it does create this sense of urgency, and the sense of urgency outcome of that is increased prices, increased competition, and prices are going up.
Makes sense. Mate, thank you very much for taking the time to come and have a chat with us. It's been very, very educational. I'm sure our listeners have benefited from it. Investors are investors are investors. And as Doc said to me this morning off air, a dollar's a dollar. I don't really care how I make it. If I can maximise my dollar, then that's what I'm here for. And I hope that's what our listeners are here for as well. Veronica, you've been very kind with your time. You are the principal of Good Deeds Property Buyers.
I am.
You are the host or co-host of the Elephant in the Room podcast. And you are the author of the upcoming next week book, Auction Ready, How to Buy Property at Auction, Even Though You're Scared Shitless, which I think will probably represent a whole lot of people. And I look forward to having a read of that book when it comes out. So have a look in your, I was going to say all good bookstores, maybe all good online booksellers.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can just go to gooddeeds.com.au or getauctionready.com.au.
That's pretty simple. Thank you very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Fools, that wraps us up. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favourite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, throw us some stars, give us a rating, tell your friends, leave us a review. It's got to be a good thing, surely. They could use a little foolish straight talk as well. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.